Like lots of minor league baseball teams, the Clinton, Iowa Lumber Kings have sent players to the majors, and they have fans who rarely miss a game. Unlike most minor league teams, the Lumber Kings also have a chronicler, because Lucas Mann spent the 2010 season with the A-level team, and in a book titled Class A Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere, he tells their story. The author joins me from Rhode Island Public Radio. Lucas Mann, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Of all the minor league baseball teams in all the world, why did you choose to spend a season with the Lumber Kings in Clinton, Iowa?
I was out in Iowa getting my MFA in writing at the University of Iowa, and it really just started with me looking for something to maybe report on, something that would potentially be a viable creative thesis topic. And I'd always loved baseball, and I knew that the Midwest League was there, so I started poking around. And it was just such a evocative place, and it's right on the Mississippi, and the stadium basically looks like it did in the 30s when it was first built, and I just sort of knew that if they let me, this has to be the place.
You provide in that first chapter a clear sense of one of the many distinctions between watching a minor league game and watching, say, the New York Yankees play. Would you read the last paragraph on the bottom of page 13 for me, please?
Sure. The nasty fans aren't crazy. It's intoxicating here, the proximity to the players and their proximity to failure. When I used to sit high up in Yankee Stadium with my father, a heckle could earn you, at best, an agreeing nod from the drunks around you, but the players I irrationally hated were bulletproof. They were so markedly better than me and everyone I knew that even when they failed, there was no power to be found in aiming cruelty in their direction. Here you can hurt them if you want. Every voice is distinguishable, and the players listen even as they pretend that they don't.
Did the players ever speak to you about whether they heard the cheers or the jeers aimed at them?
Yes, they did, and they talked about it. There would be these moments of anger and hurt that you don't get in major league stadiums. And there was even one moment that's mentioned briefly later on in the book, a fan that was always in his same place yelling at players who dogged it a little bit as they ran back in from the outfield, was screaming at this outfielder. And he just looked up into the stands and freaked out and started screaming back. And it was this strange moment of tension where this fourth wall had been broken. And everybody, both players and fans, just sort of sat silently and uncomfortably for a while.
You write that one of the attractions of watching players just starting out is that each of those players is, and I'm quoting now, somebody who doesn't know that things get worse. Did you regard that state of being with pity or with envy?
Oh, envy. Some of the players, the real stars who were sort of the signing bonus babies, I really did feel that they had been living a life where their plans had moved exactly the way they and everyone around them wanted them to. It was intoxicating to be around young people with such self-assuredness.
Nick Franklin, the star of the team, says to you at one point, "Nothing has ever gone wrong for me. I've never failed at anything. Why should I ever?"
Right. And it was sort of a striking moment of really clear-headed honesty, I thought, and he just looked back at me and said that that wasn't something he'd experienced. And against the backdrop of a town like Clinton that has been in a lot of ways failing and struggling for so long, it was just such a really pointed contrast.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the town, because one of the themes in the book is the tension between the beginning of the baseball season when, again, as you write, everything's happening all over again, and the not-so-gradual decline of Clinton, Iowa, where less and less is happening, except for Archer Daniels Midland. Talk a little bit about what the town is like and how it's come to the state that it's come to.
There is one strike that happened at the corn processing plant before Archer Daniels Midland bought it, when the town was unionized and was more of a functioning factory town in the way that I understood it. And then in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a union strike, and the union was broken. And it sort of seemed like everything turned on that axis. Mm. It's what people talk about. It still affects people's lives.
And it's not quite fair to say there's nothing but the Lumber Kings in Clinton, but it's close, I guess.
What I found in Clinton was an amazing amount of really great people that I got to know in this community that was there, of a lot of people who have stayed and have made these family lives there for generations. But in terms of sort of draws to the outside, there's the Mississippi Riverfront that's been fixed up. There's a casino on the edge of town, and there's the Lumber Kings.
Class A baseball in the middle of everywhere is as much about the most loyal fans of the Lumber Kings as anything else. And it's perhaps an exaggeration to say that there are people who live for the team, but maybe not much of an exaggeration, right, as you write about these people. Tell us a little about their most dedicated followers and what the players made of them.
Sure. One woman who ends up in the book a lot, and I even say in the book, she sort of forced her way into the narrative just by her presence and her volume, is a woman named Joyce, who I sort of became close friends with and was one of the more fascinating people I've ever met. She's a single woman in her 50s, and she works as a blackjack dealer at the casino, and she's lived in Clinton almost all of her life. She collects signatures on batting practice home run balls that she goes after and gets in the afternoon, and then she takes the balls and gets players to sign them. And her house has, I think now, over 1,000 encased in plastic signed baseballs that she can sort of find the player that you tell her to find after a little while. She's got these index cards set up. Ultimately, I found sort of an amazing amount of agency in what she did. And she was part of a larger group of fans that were really dedicated, that I sat with every day, that called themselves the baseball family. They make themselves a part of it. They are the only continuous thing in a minor league baseball world. Players change, coaches change, major league affiliates change, and then fans like Joyce and the baseball family are there as the constant in the world.
Lucas, you weren't much older than most of the players when you spent a year with the Lumber Kings. You weren't a fellow player, though. You were a guy with a notebook. But did you end up feeling as if you'd become friends with some of them?
I came to really care about a lot of the guys that I got closer to and wrote a lot about, and I was around them a lot, and we were friendly. But part of this itinerant nature of minor league baseball means that I think to them, in a lot of ways, I was like anybody that you become close to for 6 months when you're in a place that you hope to never return to.
Because you hope you'll move up, of course.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the idea.
Lucas Mann is the author of Class A Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere. The book is published by Pantheon, and the author joined me from Rhode Island Public Radio. Lucas, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much, Bill.
There's just something about minor league baseball. Maybe it's the mascots or the funny promotions or the low ticket prices, or maybe it's all of the above. What do you love about the minor league experience? Tweet your thoughts and photos to us and we'll retweet the best. Send them to us at Only a Game Radio. That's on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Music Emporium, for 45 years offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com. And Chipotle Mexican Grill, committed to the respect of animals, farmers, and the environment. Local sourcing and menu information at chipotle.com. This is NPR.
Vera, Spain is the new skinny-dipping capital of the world, or at least it was on Sunday, when 729 people without clothes splashed about in the surf, thereby setting a new world record for that activity. Hearts were heavy in New Zealand, where the old record of 506 simultaneous skinny-dippers was established just last year. But if I'd been part of that New Zealand record, I might be registering a protest with the Guinness Record people, because if you look at the photos of the event in Spain, which I don't necessarily recommend, you'll see that some of those involved were definitely wearing sunglasses. Are you really skinny dipping if you're wearing sunglasses? It seems at the very least worthy of an appeal, don't you think?
I want to go skinny dipping with you in a lake or a river or a swimming pool. We'll have fun as we try to stay cool when I go skinny dipping with you.